Live. Catch the podcast on kaya959.co.za.
Welcome to Point of View. My name is Phimola Mutin, and I'm not quite yet sitting on my chair, okay? Because Google's still here, and I just wanted to gloat a little bit.
I see a beautiful package you have in your hand, and I'm so envious. I'm so jealous. I was meant to be at the launch, but I wasn't around. I was still in the US for the fellowship. But phenomenal book by the branding extraordinaire, travel extraordinaire. I think he's traveled to every African state.
Yes, and some.
My goodness. And Mr. Thabo Ikalafeng.
Yeah.
You have his book with you.
We have him for an entire hour.
Tonight?
Tonight, of course tonight.
Thabo didn't say so.
In studio.
I am so jelly.
It's an incredible book. Get the book. So you think it's about the traveler. I think it's about more.
Really?
There is more to this book than really meets the eye. And I am so humbled to have had an opportunity to read the book because, he opens himself up. He is authentic. He's sincere. And he is vulnerable.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And I'm curious about that. I'm curious about the decisions he made to open up about a piece of his life that I think is extremely private. I'm not sure I would have shared that piece of my life.
Now I am so curious. When are you done with your copy?
I'm done with my copy. I'll buy you a copy. Done with my copy. I'm going to keep my copy and buy you a copy and get it signed for you.
Oh, Eva.
Absolutely.
Mary, do the thing.
Yeah, it's an incredible book. As I said, you think you're going to be talking. Of course he speaks about his travels. Mm. Of course he speaks about those things. But there's something else in here that I think is very personal, that I think is just one beautiful, vulnerable, sincere. And I can't wait. I can't wait to hear from you.
In my mind, I'm already thinking of the various themes that make Thabo such a wholesome man. Mm. From Kimberley, so very humble background, very closely knit to his family.
Yeah.
I remember he posted an Instagram post at one point talking about, his first visit to the airport in the 80s. And I was like, my goodness, you've been doing this for longer than what I've been alive.
Yes.
So that really just speaks to his worldview. He's very loving and passionate about his niece and constantly encourages her to study and grow. He's very passionate about brand. And having played a very significant influence with the likes of Nike in South Africa. So those are just the parts that I know of Thabo. So I'm so intrigued to get to know so much more of his fullness.
And that's good and it's expected and it's wonderful. But Thabo lifts a lid a little bit into his private life, into the family he comes from.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a story that he shares. He begins actually with that story and he ends with that story. And I just feel so, privileged to be allowed into that part of his world, his journey. That I think is very personal and I think must have taken him quite some to talk about. Although I don't get that impression, when he writes a book, he says he was dealing with a thing, and we'll get to talk about it when he's here. He just wanted to write it in. I would have paused and asked, "Do I want to write about that?" I wouldn't. I don't know. I don't know if I would.
Is there a lesson here that we're also learning, Osphimelo, in terms of people, their experiences, their stories?
Mm-hmm.
That we typically often interact with people at face value and think, Osphimelo's the current affairs broadcaster, talks all things politics, but there's so much more depth to who we are as individuals that needs to be accepted.
I often think that we're all carrying something, and it's just sometimes a matter of being really honest and asking sincerely or being aware that people aren't necessarily only what you see at surface level. And when you start peeling away at those layers, you'll be amazed at how resilient we are, what wonderful beings we are, what makes Gugu. So when people see your drive, your dedication, your commitment, sometimes there are things that drive that. And when you peel away a little bit and someone lets you in, wow, That's what he's done here.
Oh, amazing. I can't wait. When is it coming in? I'm waiting for the door to open and go.
Wait for the interview, 9 o'clock. Okay. That's when we have that conversation with him.
That's going to be exciting. Yeah. Beat's talking about some of the depressing news around the economy.
What happened to the economy, Google?
So what happened to the economy was...
Can you see? I'm sulking weather. Already. There goes my smile. There goes my smile. Google, what happened to the economy?
It's the weather. Literally, we can blame it on the weather. Yep. And that came out of stats, as say, yep. The third quarter GDP print actually declining slightly. But the largest pullback was from the agricultural space. Yep. But literally droughts and a lack of rain that we're witnessing.
When you listen to economists, they're telling you that crops are burning. Literally so. Wheat and maize, it's just not happening. Isn't that scary? I mean, there was a time when we spoke about climate change, it was a debate. Here we are now. And that an economy that everybody's been saying is going to be thriving, is thriving, and is dented in the way that we've seen now in this quarter by drought, by the heat, essentially. Right. I think it's something to really, really think carefully about and explore some more. Maybe we can do something at some other time, explore that. Yeah.
And I think you raise a very valid point, because I guess it's the weather, right? There's only so much we can do. It's an exogenous factor. We can't really influence it. But where we've often found reprieve is from importing goods from other markets. And that comes with its own challenges because the conflict between Russia and Ukraine is still ongoing. It's still impacting our grains. Yeah. Our neighboring partners are struggling with drought as well. Zambia, Zimbabwe, Mozambique are still also seeing some concerns there. And you might recall a market like India also had restrictions on trade for rice because they were prioritizing their own population. Mm-hmm. Exactly. And that also came through in the financial results of Tiger Brands. So there's always these ripple effects that we feel in the long term when there's major concerns around the economy.
I mean, speaking of which, we're going to be speaking to... we're going to be speaking about the Vaal Dam, which I suppose we are all aware now is drying up. And a couple of factors as well. You know, yes, the heat is another factor. But of course, the Lesotho Highlands North project, there's some maintenance there. So that water is not coming through. We had planned for it, but here we are now. So we'll speak about, you know, what actually needs to happen here, because we are at a phase where, as you said, there are many things happening, but climate is actually quite central to some of the issues, bigger stories that we're dealing with here.
Definitely. I'm looking forward to it, Osphimelo.
Thank you.
I'll hang around for Tebe.
Please do.
Mr. Ikalafeng. Oh, man, I can't wait. Well, all of that coming up on Point of View tonight.
Absolutely.
Fantastic. Do keep listening. You're listening to Kaya 959.
And as I said to Gugu, we have a book of the moment. I've got a book of the moment in my hands here, and the author is sitting in studio with us this evening, Tebe Ikalafeng. Thank you so much for coming through.
Thank you for waking me up.
You know,
I couldn't think of better things to do at night than to come hang out with you.
My producer and I usually joke about the fact that people at this point are in their slippers and their gowns and so on. And so it's an honor to have you come through.
No, it's my honor. Thank you.
What a book.
The best-selling book in the country.
What a book.
The number one Christmas book everybody wants to have in their list. I think it's because of the cover. So I was thinking, because something must be working. I say it's the cover. It's the EFF hat. Something.
Well, it's many things. Yes, at, you know, face value, it's the cover.
I'm being silly.
And the handsome man on the cover.
Oh, you've been
and the
kind.
Fantastic photography my that goes along with it.
My retainer is working on you.
And the photography that went along with it and. And then there's the idea that you think you're going to be talking about just your travel.
Right.
And that's
what I tell people. I said to people, anybody who's looking to find out what to do, where to do, how to do, is in for a surprise.
No, it is a surprise. It's a beautiful surprise.
Thank you so much.
I was telling Gugu that I feel so privileged to have read the book, because you've opened a window into a piece of you that I think is very, very personal, very sincere. I'm not sure I would have gone to some of the places you went to.
Are you? You wouldn't. What, paternity?
Yeah, no.
And my drunk teachers. I mean, It's not classically a biography or an autobiography.
Yes.
It is a memoir. It is reflections.
Yes.
Or on a journey.
Yes.
And when I was going to write this, I was going to say, I need to write about what I saw as I traveled the continent.
Mm-hmm.
But I said, but to travel the continent started somewhere.
Yes.
It started at home.
Mm.
So if I'm going to write about traveling, then I must write where the journey started.
Mm.
And when I write about where the journey started, then I said, I mustn't write in half measures. I must be honest about some of the experiences, the moments which have shaped how I approach life and how I travel. Because how I travel and how I approach life was pretty much founded in my elementary stages.
Your grandmother knew you were a traveler.
My grandmother's a problem. because my grandmother used to say, Tebe Ololao.
Yeah.
I don't know how to say it in English. Some things you can't say in English, right?
Yeah, but it's not the same.
It's not the same. Tell me you've got the food.
The food.
I used to say that all the time because I'd wake up and I'd hit the road.
Yeah.
I wake up and hit the road, whether it's to, and I come back ashy as hell. Then my uncles would now whoop me.
Yeah.
Or I go out and visit friends. I go out play tennis, go out play football. There's probably nothing I didn't do.
Yeah.
But I was always on the road.
And I, you know, you, some of the stories you tell, I almost want to stop you and say, take it slower, because I want to hold on to the story. Your matric year was quite an incredible year.
My school year was interesting.
Yes.
I remember, because my matric, I did matric for what, 6 weeks or 8 weeks?
Weeks.
Yeah, we did matric in weeks.
And still aced it.
And still aced it. Well, we never went to.
Yeah.
I mean, because.
Background.
84 was a very important year in this country. Because 84, the country came to a standstill.
Mm-hmm.
And 85. The apartheid government then says, well, state of emergency, then we're stopping everybody.
Mm.
These black kids are unruly.
Mm.
And they did this, within the first couple of months of the year.
Mm.
And so closed schools were closed for the rest of the year. And then in September or so, our principal brother, Madden, who's still alive, is 91,
really?
92. Well, he was at my book launch in Kimberley last week.
Really?
And he's still alive. It's an incredible lucid mind. In September, he calls us, he says, he's an Irish guy, and he says, if you guys want to write exams...
Just go for it.
Go for it. Because at that time, I think the UDF, Motlana, and everybody had said, he said to the apartheid government, you better open this course.
Mm.
You better open, you better lift this emergency. But then it was already late. Then I remember some of my friends, my classmates, then we said... Let's go for it. They like jealous. We're gonna fail anyway. Who writes after not being in school for the rest of the year? Because it's September now. Yeah. So from February to September, there's I don't know how many months it is. But it's a long time. And some of us like, yeah, man, let's do like a crash course on Yana to review.
For next year.
So that to if prepare, we fail,
we will
next
know.
Year we're closer to getting to passing with A's. Yeah. You know? But I remember I was first most of my life, school life. So I was used to being first.
Mm.
And so I expected nothing less of whether I write matric after going to school for 2 months or for 20 years. I still expected I'm going to be top of that class.
Mm.
And I mean, I always perform on form.
But what I thought was incredible about that story is that you had a gentleman who's still alive now who says, let's just go for it, man. Let's just go for it, right? But then very close to you are schools where you don't have the same type of principal.
Right. And so if you look at the schools, my school is interesting. And I was in Kimberley this past week to launch my book at home.
Mm-hmm.
And what was so interesting was where my school is located,
mm-hmm.
on the left-hand side,
mm-hmm.
is a white suburb.
Mm-hmm.
When I say left, I'm not saying left. I say left.
Mm-hmm.
As in there's a road.
Mm-hmm.
You're in a white suburb.
Mm-hmm.
On the right-hand side is Indians.
Mm-hmm.
In front is a black township.
Mm-hmm.
And in my school is white teachers,
mm-hmm.
Irish, and black teachers. Some of them are drugs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it was interesting how my school was located.
Mm-hmm.
But our school, our anthem was St. Boniface is number one.
Mm-hmm.
Because I went to a Catholic school. Yes. And it was a Catholic black private school.
Yes.
And our school was always number one. Mm. And it's always number one. I remember, I think, one of the worst performing schools in Kimberley then was Tsireletso, I think that's the name. And the kids had actually made a representation to our principal at the beginning of the year. And they said to our principal, we'd want to come for extra classes from you guys, maybe some of your teachers. Some of us would say, let's help you. Maybe we won't. But we were voted out, so we didn't have them. But our school was that good.
Mm. And you speak of the girls who didn't have that.
I went to a boys' school, and on the other half was the girls.
Yes.
So now the girls had to repeat. They had to go into standard. Women have always been undertreated. Apologize. The patriarchal society. But then what's interesting is the following year, because now some kids were moving up, they had to create a standard six.
A form six,
which is grade 13.
Yeah.
So that the others can do their class, so that others can move forward. But also standard six, I also didn't write exams for standard six, which is grade 8.
Grade 8.
Grade 8. Again, the entire Kimberley now was disrupted. Mm. And when the school started the next year, the teacher says, you really done substantial. Just move forward. Actually, I think, I only did 3 years of school. I did 3 years of matric of high school. I still don't tell the Minister of Education.
No, we won't tell anybody.
I'll be in trouble because it's just between us.
It is absolutely just between us. You take us through your journey in a wonderful way because it's your journey, but you also map out what's happening around the world, what's happening around the continent. You speak of course, you were earlier on interested in the world as in the world outside of the continent. Then you did that and dusted that. Then you were keen to do the continent. Then you did that and dusted that. But you were interested in something else. These really interesting places where they're located in the continent, but and they're not African.
So when I finished the rest of the continent, I then said to myself, but I'm quite keen to figure out where Mayotte and Réunion and then Canary Islands and St. Helena, why are they not African?
Yes.
Because these countries are right in Africa, if you will. It's just like Mauritius. It's just a little water between us or Cabo Verde and all those. It's just next door. Mm-hmm. And my interesting one is when I went to Réunion, it was very, very, they're like Cape Town, Makalat.
Yes.
That's how I looked at them. I said, it's like mixed race. The French have done a really good job here of blending in here, and it's all mixed. Then, because I did a trip in one trip. Then when I got to the airport to go to Mayotte, so I'm at the airport, and then I go to the gate, I think maybe gate 3, whatever it was. So I get to gate, the color is changing. I'm at the airport, I'm still in Réunion. So either you're going to France on the left-hand side, where everybody is white and light. Then when I go to the right, everybody is dark. And then when I landed in Mayotte, I'm going down and I just see a sea of blackness. And then, but the line is white people, the French, the Gendarmerie, the ones who are now stamping and all those things. And I found it so interesting because now the sea of blackness reminded me of us in Africa, us in the confirmed Africa. They're dressed in this shweshwe, whatever, fabric. They're dark like me. They smell like me. Some of them are as ugly as me. So it's just how we are. So with the beauty of Africa was right there in front of me. And I find it quite interesting. And matter of fact, when I then went through Mayotte, which is probably a fundamental, it's a transformational change as how I look at life as well. As I do and I go to different countries, I always not stay at the best hotels. Mm-hmm. Or if I do, I won't tell you. Mm-hmm. But I always stay with the people. I always hang out with the people. Mm-hmm. I eat where they eat. I dress where they dress and hang out. And then I always end up with the ugliest car, decrepit. Maybe something's not working. And I find this taxi driver.
Yes. And you hold on to
I'm an energy person. Yes. So if I walk into a place and I look at you, I'm like, you're my person.
Yes.
So we drive with this guy. Yes. And I spend the weekend with him. He picks me up from the hotel every time. Mm-hmm. Then he goes. Because the one day I went to go football with him because he plays football. Then one day I said to him, I see where you live. He's like, no, you can't go. I said, what do you mean? He's like, people like you don't.
No.
No, we can't take you there. I said, I'm like you. We're like dark. We're black. So, you know, we go to the place, we go up, up, up. And I mean, Masenke, like, you know, like our townships and like where we all are from. And I go up there and I come down. Then I go see football. We eat magwenya and mince. We do all those things. Now, at the end of the trip, I'm absolutely fascinated by this experience I've just gone through. So as I'm driving, I'm approaching the airport. As I'm approaching the airport, I say to him, "Mon ami, I don't understand why you say you're French." I said, "Because you're dark like me, you dress like me, you smell like me, you love like me. To me, you like me." And he says to me, "Mon ami, the passport is French. But my heart is African." So everywhere I went, I tried to find that heart and the people who have that heart, who belong to us.
And in that, so much of our history is told in that little sentence.
So much of our history about our diaspora, about our dispersed, rather, people who have been displaced, rather, from the main continent. Or whether it is, I mean, the same story when I go to St. Helena, the Reunion. These people are clearly from here. They are clearly part of us. And many of them identify with us, but like but like some of them told me, they said, "But we are here for the benefits, the English benefits, the Spanish benefits of Canary Islands, the French benefits of Réunion and Mayotte." But they said, "But we're Africans. And then, you know, because every place I went to, I don't think there's a place I've gone to where I haven't said, "Show me where our people got here. Show me how our people live. Show me the history of how they used to treat our people." So I've been to all the slave museums. I've been to all the, pretty much wherever Africans have been, how they entered the place. So, I mean, you know, this new Apple software is a mess. I had all my pictures lined up properly. I could say, "Show me." "Give me the folder of all the slave doors of no return." I could, but now they've messed it up. But we'll see. But, you know, I arranged my life that way and my experiences that way. Because I wanted, when I come back, and because people always ask me, "But why did you have to do this?" I said, I wanted to ensure that I have a lived experience, I have a lived account, an authentic account, an incredible account of our history, of our continent. Because, you know, a study was done by Africa No Filter that established that 63% of the people who write about our continent
is not African,
have never been here. So, and you also, and they just released a new study now that says £3.2 billion. So they said that Africa pays an additional £3.2 billion in interest on our sovereign debt because of the negative perception or the negative coverage of Africa. So now, how are you going to fix that? You need Africans telling the African story, because we need to correct our story.
It wasn't so long ago. I actually remember it when most parts of the continent was singing Nkosi Sikelele Afrika.
Do you know when
you picked that up?
So you know when I landed in Tanzania for to go climb Kilimanjaro, because you know on this journey, as you know, I've done everything that anybody should do. I've climbed Kilimanjaro, I've climbed mountains anywhere else, I've bungee jumped facing crocodiles, I have skydives where the sea meets the sand dunes. I've done all those crazy things. And then when I landed in the one crazy thing to go to climb Kilimanjaro, and I arrived at the school. So remember, I went to the Mandela Foundation for the Mandela Track for Mandela, and they were going to donate the pads. And then we arrived at this place, and as we walk in, and then they welcome us, and they go, "Nkosi Sikelele," but in Kiswahili. So I'm listening to this, I say, "But that's my..." So I said, "They're so nice. They're singing for us." They sing our national anthem just for us. And then, of course, the truth of the matter is, the history is Tanzania. And last week I was in Zambia. Last week I was in Kimberley. The week before I was in Tanzania. And because it was a presidential event, there was a national anthem song. And it's also the same
ours. This is it.
And then I remember that Zimbabwe was also the same.
This is it.
And so what travel does, it opens your eyes and your eyes to what binds us more than what divides us.
Yeah.
But also tells you a little bit about the history of the continent, that there was a time where the independence liberation leaders had an idea of a united Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And part of uniting Africa is uniting it with the symbolism, the cultures, and all those things.
Mm-hmm.
And this anthem, which was written by a South African, was the anthem that all of them had chosen will be the anthem for Africa.
My guest is Thebe Ikalafeng. I'm going to take your calls, actually, if you like. 086-000-00959. The book is called The Traveller, Crossing Borders and Connecting Africa. This is your selection.
Oh, I love it. It's do you know the thing that's beautiful about our continent is our culture.
Mm.
And our culture is what? It's our food, it's our music, it's our language.
Mm.
You know, I went to Benin. When I came out of Benin, I said, let me just go see where Fela Kuti lived. So I went to Fela Kuti's house. And then when you go to Fela Kuti's house, obviously it's been there for a while, Fela Kuti's out there. I mean, his house is exactly the kept as a museum.
Yeah.
And then the young man who used to be his mentee, who used to follow him everywhere else, was there. Who joined Fela, I think was like 16, this guy. And he said, you know, Femi, the son, is playing tonight at the Shrine. I'm like, say no more.
I'm coming.
Are we doing backstage? Yeah. It's like, brother. Is there anything less for you? So we went to backstage and we went to Femi. He performed for 2 hours, the high energy.
Yeah.
And I was like, this child is his father's son.
Yes.
Child. Right? So our music is beautiful. I mean, and by the way, you don't even have to understand what they're saying. Like, truly, I mean, honestly, Nono's got nothing to do with tonight.
No.
But it's a beautiful rhythm. It's and people play it at celebratory functions, you know, whether it's rugby or football, when they see that we're winning.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they're playing.
Many of us remember exactly where we were when Madiba passed away. You were in the U.S. After a keynote address that you had given.
No, two things.
Yeah,
I'm sleeping in bed.
Yes.
In South Africa.
Yes.
And a message comes that says the state president, Jacob Zuma, will be addressing the nation.
Mm-hmm.
Now, remember, we've been waiting for Mandela. So not waiting.
No, I know exactly what you mean.
But you know what I mean.
I know in fact, it's not even, you're not being unkind. It's exactly what it was.
It was a 6 month.
It was.
Yeah.
It was.
And remember, the earlier, 6 months earlier, before he died, I wrote a definitive obituary on Mandela.
Mm.
And it was a full page on the Star.
Mm.
And then he didn't die.
I know many people went
on the Sunday. So the Saturday night, I changed the last line. I took out rest in peace and I published it. And I started publishing it, right? And then anyway, so then December 5.
Yes.
Then I'm in bed.
Yes.
And I see the message. Mm. Then I get up
and
I go to Houghton. I'm going to tell you how the U.S. comes in. I run to Houghton.
Yes.
And it was 2 a.m. I think when I got there, 11 or 12.
Yes.
It was packed.
Yes.
And then I was en route anyway the following to the U.S.
Because the address is on the 13th, I think, or something like that. All right, okay.
So now remember there was a memorial, I think that's what we're talking about, where Barack Obama spoke.
That's correct.
And I was in
Vegas. You were already there, yeah.
So now I'm
there.
In the
U.S.
And I had to go speak. And you know, Maya Angelou had just written that beautiful, his day is done.
Yeah.
I've never come across a more beautiful obituary, which is a poem or just a tribute to a person.
Mm.
And I went and addressed, I don't know how many, there must have been 2,000-3,000 people in that room. You know, America does everything big. So I went and spoke.
Mm.
And I closed off on the leadership. Let me tell you, as I finished the speech, I just wailed. The whole place was already up. And then later I got into a plane and then in the plane I watched, luckily, from Vegas to New York. I was in a plane that was having CNN live. So I watched the entire thing when Barack spoke about Mandela. It was an incredible moment because I experienced the loss from home and from how everybody else felt about him. Because, you know, Mandela was the embodiment of a type of leadership the continent deserves.
Mm.
He was not perfect, but he was human.
Mm.
And I think that was the difference.
Mm.
And that was, today's the 6th of Feb.
Today is the, what's today?
That's the day Mandela today, passed.
It's today.
It's the day Mandela passed.
Can you believe it?
Crazy.
That's Isn't the day that crazy? Passed. It is the day he
and,
passed.
And you know, I'll never forget Barack Obama's speech.
Mm.
Of course, then we had the interpreter.
Yeah.
The sign language guy.
You mean the hands flopping.
The hands flopping and all those things. But you know, everywhere I went in the continent, I also tried to understand what else binds us. And whether it is on Djibouti, whether it is Namibia, whether anywhere else, whether it is in Ethiopia, there will be something about Mandela. There will be a street about Mandela,
yeah.
a school about Mandela,
yeah.
an airport in Cabo Verde about Mandela, in Djibouti, streets about Mandela. Mm-hmm. Everywhere there's something about Mandela, which spoke to what he meant for us.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Cosmo, we're not looking for perfect people. We're not looking for saints.
Yeah.
We're looking for people who try just a little bit better to try and leave this continent better than they found it.
So there was one moment in this entire book where I could have sworn you were irritated.
Oh, which was that moment?
Only one moment. You don't say that you're irritated.
Which one is
but
that?
I was chuckling. I was killing myself. When you came across Kim Kardashian. You were not impressed.
First, I'm flying from Botswana. So Kim had landed in South Africa.
Yes.
And the Beers had hired, or the Beers Anglo had hired Kim to promote.
Yes.
And then I'm in the plane. First, I've never met this midget. So now I'm in the plane. So I landed in South Africa, in Joburg, from Botswana to Joburg. She's now done whatever she's done.
Yes.
It's her, it's Chloe, and she was dating Reggie Bush.
Yes, the
tall,
player.
Good-looking Reggie Bush. Yes, then. Yes. And then I'm seeing this 1.1-meter tall woman. I don't know how tall he is. And then this tall American football giant.
Yes.
And the thing was like, hey, it's you. You get paid to come and tell us about us. We're here. We can tell our story. But you know, it's.
And she tweets.
When she landed in South Africa, she goes, Botswana, South Africa. I was like, Kim. Botswana is an independent country. South Africa is an independent country. Matter of fact, I still have the tweet exactly as it is. Probably in the book I just wrote about it, but I have the tweet as it is. Poor soul. But you know, that's the thing with the continent.
Yeah.
Everybody sees Africa as one place.
Yeah.
When you get to travel, you see from Cape to Cairo, we are 54 to 55 different countries or 60 different countries, multiple languages, multiple cultures, and that's the beauty about Africa.
So, this is the part where I say I was privileged to read your book.
Mm.
It starts actually with this and it ends with this. It's you and who you are, your legacy, your long legacy before you, and the legacy about you and of you that will continue. And it was so heartwarming to see you open up about that in the most sincere way that I think you could have. And this is your journey of searching for your father.
Well, let me first say I didn't search for this nigga. Let me just say. I'm like a typical.
I was going to correct myself quickly because that was not the right word.
Yeah, but let me just say, I'm your typical South African. Because it's a horrible thing to say I'm a typical South African. South African black kid. Where, you know, half our fathers move around trees and they forget where they peed. Obviously I didn't. I grew up not knowing mine, but I grew up remembering the prem that he gave us,
Yes,
me. And he didn't even send us a prem.
Yes.
He sent it through a friend.
Mm.
And that prem stayed.
But stayed in your family. Yeah?
It stayed in my family, went down to my sister. Because I always say that, you know, this prem, I think, had a longer relationship with us than he had with my mother.
Yes.
So be that as it may, we know in the township when you say to your father, Mama, Papa. Mama, Papa, are we not doing a good job here? Is there anything? What is wrong? Are we not doing a good job? So it's almost like in a township, in black societies we're growing up, if you're questioning paternity, particularly if the father is not around, it's almost like we have a tuga or a rohaga, you know? And be that as it may, I spend my whole life not worrying about this. Because, you know, I've already been told, otlaba lulim. What are you? So you moved on with life. And then in my 40s, then I took my mom on the blue train.
Yes. And you asked.
And asked, for some reason, you know, we're just the two of us. I mean, we dressed up every day for dinners. The blue train is a 48-hour ride. Look beautiful, the train, just the two of us. And there was a time, I think we're approaching Pretoria now. And if you see the blue train, there's a picture of us actually. If you see the blue train, it's a long, you see the journey behind, or the journey you're approaching rather. And I just said, you know, let's talk about that guy. Who, I'll talk about two things. I said, what name did you have for me? I was always going to be Thebe. It's like, no, you weren't going to be Thebe. As far as I'm concerned, I wanted you to be Khosi, the king. And but your grandmother, Oloyangwele.
No, not at all. You adore her.
My grandmother. Yeah. I was just saying,
you adore her.
She bewitched me with the feet, with the walking, with the traveling. But she says, but your grandmother says, no. We are going to call him Thebe Itsile. The shield has arrived. I think maybe she had her own grand ideas about this one's going to come, is going to protect us. I think, you know, it's some people now cashing in on people's insurances. I think I was my grandmother's insurance. So I think that's how she looked at me.
You lived up to that.
That part. So then I was interesting. And I said, the man, it's like, oh, you know, we met, didn't go anywhere, had no interest in this pregnancy when I got pregnant. And I just moved on. And my grandmother raised you. I was like, fine, no problem. We move on with our lives. So now we have a little bit of knowledge about the person and the idea. So then I move on with my life, right? So now I'm done with the book. So now we move on. Now I'm in the 50s. Now I've finished the book.
2024.
This year.
This is it.
This year, I've now decided, under duress, I'm going to write a book. Because now I had no intentions of writing a book. So under duress, I write the book. I finished the book in September. The book now is ready for production. It's not with me anymore. On Friday, I think, or whatever, maybe a couple of days later, Wednesday or so, the publisher says, that's it. It's now gone to print. On Monday, they press the button. Now it's Friday morning. My nephew calls me in the morning, 4-5, uncle, we're coming over for your other nephew's funeral, whatever it is, our memorial. We are going to go. We're going to do the trip. I'm like, and he says that. And I say, oh, okay, yeah, so you have money for petrol. I say, sure, he has money for petrol. Someone come with your mother, my mother, his grandmother. I say, sure, no problem. I move on in my life, you know, because I know he was also talking about finding a job at Coke. And then anyway, so I go to Agricola now. So I went to Lesotho. So now I'm in Lesotho that night. 8 p.m. or so, phone rings. The message rings. Uncle, breakthrough.
Yeah.
So I'm like, breakthrough? You got the job? Because I'm going to be talking about interviews. Because I wasn't reading much about, because he said, we're going to do the trip.
Yeah.
Or we're going to, you know, your father. But he didn't really go into too much details. Because I just said, whatever, because we spoke about it. He had spoken about it once. And then he says to me, I found your family.
Stainsrus. Yeah.
First, I've never heard of the city of the place.
Yes.
I've never heard of Stainsrus. Now I had to Google the place. Because, you know, my mother met my father in Stilfontein.
Yes.
And which is where he used to live.
Yes.
So now it's Stainsrus, right? So now he says, he sent me pictures. And then eerily, these natives look like me. And I know exactly how I'm going to look because they're also a bit... So I know how exactly I'm going to look. So I'm going to spread out. So anyway, so I was like, wow. So I said, where are they? She's like, yeah. I said, how far is it? She says, 2.5 hours from Joburg. I'm like, crazy. I said, I'll see you on Saturday. We're going to talk about this. So it comes home to Saturday. So I come home. So now I'm supposed to come Sunday because we're going to take a long ride from there. So I decided, let's just come now. So I come on Saturday. I fly Saturday morning, come home. And my nephew comes, my mother's with my sister, not far from my house. And then he comes and he tells me the story about these people. He says, uncle, I walk in and I just saw you.
And they say you just like him. They say he's got your personality. I can see, I look at your face now. But they say you just like him.
So now, that's exactly what he says. So now that's what he tells me.
Yes.
So then I said to myself, it's Saturday.
Yes.
Tomorrow, I'm doing the trip myself. So I get into the car, call my sister, call a friend, we got on the car. 2.5 hours, we arrive at this place. First, we are lost because we don't know how to get in. And then we've been calling this person, the auntie, but we didn't tell him that Tab is coming. My sister just said, oh, we're coming to say hi. My son was there yesterday. I'm coming to say hi. So, okay, whatever. So we go in. So we get to a field, a football field, and then they say, you have to go this way and that way. And then now we have the pictures from the night before. My sister looks out, says, there's your auntie. I said, where is that one coming out of a taxi? The one we've been talking to, she says, is in Velcom. But now Velcom is not far from there.
Yeah, yeah.
So be there as it may. Meanwhile, she had come back because she'd forgotten her keys.
Oh, wow.
So when she says she's in Velcom, she's actually on the way back.
Yes.
So this woman comes up, opens the door. I'm sitting on the passenger side. I open the window. She's like, my brother's son. And like, this is so real. So then we go to the houses. We move around, get to meet everybody else. I walk in and they say to me, you are crazy like your father.
Yes.
They said, you know, they said he used to dress up well.
Just
he
like
was a
you.
Debonair. And my sister says, like my brother.
Yes.
And that's sort of how that circle closed. So I called her. So and anyway, I mean, the end is interesting because I now get to find out that he squandered his life. He was quite wealthy. He lived in Petersburg or somewhere at shops and all those things. And he squandered his life. And he came home to die.
Let's talk about the dates.
The dates are surreal. So now I'm looking at the dates. I'm like, this man was born in 1933. My grandfather came to South Africa in 1933. And I'm like, this is crazy. And I think there was a 1919 date, right, as well, which is also my grandmother's, my maternal grandmother's birth date. So these things are interesting. How dates, I mean, I don't believe in a whole lot of these things.
Yeah.
But I was just looking at these dates. Oh, this is incredible. Well, he died in 83. I was still in high school, so obviously never got to see him. And they say, you know, they say your grandmother went to pick him up from Petersburg. The women had finished. I mean, you know how people speak.
Yes,
I don't know if the woman finished or he finished himself. But anyway, they said the woman had, this woman he loved so much, had finished every single penny he had. He came with only the clothes he had on and came home to die. And that's how I finished the book by saying, at least now I know. That's the end of that book.
The people closest to you, some, kept asking you, so how do you feel about it? You don't answer that question in the book.
I don't answer. Well, I answered it in the ways. I mean, because they were putting words in my mouth. They said, how do you feel? Like, and they were like, closure. I said, I guess closure.
No.
I was like, I was fine. Do you know, my only emotion about that whole episode was the minute I finished the last line. I didn't tell you what happened, sorry, because I found out on Friday the book is going to print, right?
Yeah.
So what did I do? I called the publisher at 8 o'clock.
And you said, not now.
I said, book has to be withdrawn.
Wait,
he says, no, we can't do that, Tebe. You're already 1 month out. The book was supposed to be out in September. He says, you're already 1 month out. And now it's September. Now you want to move it out and it's not scheduled to be an October holiday book. I'm like, I have to write one more chapter. I have to finish off the book. And when I finished the book, and that's how I finished the book, at least now I know. Only at that moment was I overcome with the emotion of the moment to say, flip. So now I truly do know who I am.
How does it make you feel?
Well, it's a closure. Because there's nothing else I can do. And having said so, like millions of South African kids, the 60-70% who grew up without a father in the household, the millions of kids whose fathers have denied them or whose fathers just disappeared or who don't even know if their fathers exist, like all of them, who were raised by incredible women, who were raised by incredible grandmothers and mothers, who made sure that just because somebody else has deserted their responsibility, they're not going to reset their responsibility. They've been great mothers and great fathers at the same time. That's why sometimes on Father's Day, I always wish the mothers well who've stepped in to play the role of the fathers who just didn't step up to the plate. So how do I feel? It's closure. There's nothing else to it. I still don't have a picture, by the way. That's a crazy thing.
I know. You
I still
say
have a
that,
picture because...
But at least you have a surname now. You only had a name for years.
I'm just the first name. So the other, those names, Lukhotla...
No. He at least now has a surname.
Kisani. Yeah, he's got Lukhotla Kisani, Stilfontein, Stendres. That's his identity. The identity that made me. It's my grandfather from Botswana,
absolutely.
My grandmother from Taung, and my mother. And that's who I am.
And the uncles you speak so fondly of.
Oh, my
your
uncles.
Wonderful uncle. I love your uncle, by the way. I love your uncle.
My uncles are typical South African
uncles. Yes, I love
you. I mean, unless it's been an interesting life. I mean, I speak like it's the end of it. It's an interesting life. I mean, I had incredible formative years. I had interesting school life, you know, because I used to teach my classmates. Yes. I used to mark their papers.
Yes.
Because half my teachers were drunk.
And the discipline not to give them the marks. I thought that's incredible. I think that's leadership.
I mean,
right,
and that's why I'm saying that when people ask me, how did you get here? What made you who you are? I said, it's all those years. The fact that I was teaching my classmates, the fact that I was marking my classmates, all those taught me how to lead, but also taught me objectivity in a way.
Yes.
Because I now need to be objective.
Yes.
That I can't say Pamela is my friend.
Yes.
Let me give her 99. I just have to say, Pamela, you didn't measure up.
But look, it also speaks to the teachers that entrusted you with that responsibility. I mean, I know they were not supposed to be because they were doing things they should not be doing.
They are lucky the ones living in the Gen Z era. In the Gen Z era, those teachers would be hung out dry. But it was interesting. But you know, people say, and someone has told me just today, someone saying to me, says, do you know these delinquent teachers? A friend of mine was saying to me, people are complaining about delinquent teachers. And he says, you know, when I read your book, I realized that delinquency has been around all
there.
Our lives.
They were there.
They were always there. The fact that a teacher can arrive drunk at school,
the
fact that a teacher can entrust a 15-year-old to mark their papers of his classmates because he's afraid that he's going to lose his job.
Yeah.
The fact that, you know, they can impregnate, because in my school time, they would impregnate girls. Mm. You have all that stuff. The fact that that can happen should not be allowed in society and shouldn't be allowed even today, and it's been happening throughout history. And I wrote the way I wrote it. As I mean, most people read the book, obviously, they feel like I was this. Some people say to me, like you're sitting right next to me, talking to me about this only. I wrote it, I didn't want to write above myself. I wrote how I speak, but also importantly, most people who've read it, the first quarter of the book, they say, that's my story. They say, I can relate to all this. If not personally, but people I know have gone through that. Because there's a mixture of telling the history of the country without going into historical.
Absolutely.
It was a mixture of telling growing up in a township without glorifying township life. Just putting life as it is.
The book is called The Traveler, Crossing Borders and Connecting Africa by Thebe Ikalafeng. When I come back, there'll be more. What a beautiful song.
You know, that song speaks to the idea. Because, you know, she says, I was formed with love and all those. It speaks to how every single one of us starts with love. We are made out of love, most of us at least.
Yeah.
And most of us as well are destined to be something or somebody in life. And if you remember how you were raised, if you remember where you come from, you arrive where you're meant to be. Because that's why, you know, I think about the song about the Temptations.
Yes.
I've never been to me. And, you know, they all speak to the same idea that, you know, if you remember where you come from, if you remember, if you get back to who you are yourself, you will get where you ought to go.
I imagine that the writing of the book got you to sit and pause for a minute and reflect. This is your life, so you've been living the life. This is you and your journey. But I imagine sitting and writing this book forced you to sit and pause What were your reflections when you did that?
So, in the first part, I wanted to put into context what made me as a township kid, born and raised in a township. I wanted to reflect, but I didn't want to, and I was very careful about not glorifying this, but also not dwelling in the in the challenges and all those, because all of us grew up in challenges. And I always tell people, I did not grow up poor.
But it's a very optimistic book.
I grew up rich in spirit.
Yes.
I grew up believing that I can be anything. Because poverty is how you think about yourself. It's how you reflect on your circumstances. George Bernard Shaw says the people who get ahead in life are not the people who dwell on the circumstances they're in, but the ones who create the circumstances they want in life. So I was very careful when I was looking back and forth. I says, am I glorifying these things? Am I telling her? I wanted to be honest. I was very honest. That's the first part.
Yes.
So when I looked at my corporate life, I wanted to reflect as well. Because it was so interesting that I meet so many people and they say to me, we never saw one like you in corporate. You were a trailblazer in marketing and branding. You were our benchmark. Somebody says you were a reference point. And these people are superstars now. They're superstar marketers, brand builders. And I wanted to go back and try and understand, so what is it that I did without praising myself, but just explaining how I did things? Because a lot of people now do not know how some of us, the us, the Happy Shinglers, the Peter Wondlers, even older than me and all those, how they created an enabling environment for the successes that most people take for granted today. How we challenge the status quo, being the first blacks in the areas we were in, the first post-apartheid, how we do this. So I want to reflect on that, but I wanted to put it crudely as it happened. And I think you see that as well. And this is a journey, by the way, from where I started to corporate, to America, to back here. And then when I came to the Africa journey, or rather the last part of the book, where I now go through anything beyond South Africa and what I learned across, I wanted to reflect on what binds us. And when I looked at what binds us, and I said, we're a very resilient people. If you look at who, whether it's Rwanda, what they've gone through, what the people in Sudan are going through, what the Ethiopians went through in the 80s, we're a resilient people. And we are a very welcoming people. Because everywhere I went, I arrived as a stranger, but I left as a friend. I left with friends, I left with family, I became one and all those. And that's humanity to who we are. And there is a resourcefulness about who we are. So sort of the things, and I wanted to figure out the experiences which map out that story, or rather that's what I saw when I wrote. And that's why I don't write about everything, I write about the thing that binds us.
You do. It's an incredible book.
I appreciate
it. It's a beautiful book.
I've been told.
Thank you. Thank you for penning it. Thank you for, it's a beautiful love letter to us as people, to the continent, and to humanity. It's beautiful.
Thank you so much. I mean, I've been told that the book is a very humble book. It's a very honest book.
It's an honest book.
And but nobody's, and I love that. I love the feedback. The book has done phenomenally well. Sold out within 3 weeks. Waiting for new reprints. Stressed about it because can't find the book in shelves now, but it should be out in the next couple of days, I've been told. But I'm very honored that people bought the book. I'm very honored that people found the book worth reading. I'm honored that when I launched it, as I've been told, it was the biggest launch since Mandela's launch 30 years ago. And that said something to me. It said all our stories matter. And we must recognize that all of us have played some part in the history of this country at any point. And even the ones who are born today are playing a part. And we must record our stories. Because as Chinua Achebe said, until the lion learns how to tell its story, tales of the hunter will always be glorified.
all proceeds are going to be assisting students.
100% yes. of all royalty proceeds out of here are going to a scholarship, in addition to the money that I'll be pledging on top of it, in addition to what I'll be doing with the marketing industry in the country to create the next generation of African brands. And I did that because only 20% of the brands that Africans admire are made in Africa. It means that we need to do something more than preach about it. Mm. We need to create the talent, invest in the talent, and nurture the talent that will create more Tsepos, more Maxhosas, more Batus, more Drips, and all those, and learn from those experiences. And the MTNs, the big ones, the MTNs of the world.
Tebe Kalafing, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Appreciate the opportunity. It was worth staying up for you, with you. The music was incredible.
The book is called The Traveler, Crossing Borders and Connecting Africa by Tebe Ikalafeng. That's it from us today. I'll be back on Monday at 8.
If you missed it live, catch the podcast on kaya959.co.za.